This is Barron's Live. Each weekday, we bring you live conversations from our newsrooms about what's moving the market right now. On this podcast, we take you inside those conversations, the stories, the ideas, and the stocks to watch so you can invest smarter. Now, let's dial in.
Hello, everyone, and welcome to Barron's Live, our daily webcast and podcast. I'm Lauren Rublin, Senior Managing Editor of Barron's. Thanks for joining us today to learn more about investing in tech stocks. My guest is Barron's Deputy Editor, Alex Yule. Like most of us at Barron's, Alex wears many different hats. He oversees our technology coverage, and he also hosts his own podcast, The Readback. He just launched a new season of The Readback yesterday. It's all about self-driving cars and why they're taking so long to arrive. I urge you to check it out on Barron's.com, Apple Podcasts, or your preferred podcast site. Alex, in my opinion, is a podcast pro, and The Readback is something really special. We'll talk more about it in a bit. But first, Alex, catch us up on how tech stocks are doing.
Hey, Lauren. Thanks. I think it's interesting. The NASDAQ sell-off seems like it's ebbed or slowed down a little bit. It's still down about 5% from its peak in early September, its all-time high. But actually, in the last week, tech stocks and the NASDAQ as a proxy are outperforming a little bit. A couple weeks ago, or less than 2 weeks ago, the NASDAQ was down almost 8% from its peak. So, you know, maybe some progress there. It seemed like the NASDAQ was headed for correction territory. Now it's kind of just hanging in. And I guess you could call that progress, right?
Well, certainly I call today progress across the board. Everything is up today.
Yeah, right. This is true.
Pretty exciting after the grim month we've had.
Absolutely. I think what's happening, so partly it's at least with tech, that the 10-year treasury and interest rates have stabilized a bit. So you've had this kind of the 10-year treasury yield plateauing or hovering around like 1.52% now. So I think that helps growth stocks and tech stocks, because they tend to wobble, as we've talked about, as bond yields rise. So maybe that's one issue of why the sell-off has eased a little bit. But as you said, you know, today's a good day. I think there's also this realization that earnings season is coming, or it's here now at this point. It's here, right? We had bank earnings this week. And I think it's coming right just in time. You know, we've been dealing with so much uncertainty around Washington, in Washington specifically, and the pandemic. And I'm kind of thinking of this earnings season as the return of stability. I think particularly—
We're gonna find out, in other words, while we're dealing with all sorts of other problems, just how strong the tech sector really is.
Yeah, I mean, I think so. And look, is it going to be strong across the board, or as strong as it was 3 months ago, 6 months ago? Maybe not. I think, but for one thing, it's going to be like real numbers and just that lack of uncertainty. So I think you're filling in that vacuum with lots of facts, and I think investors ultimately will come to appreciate that. And I think, you know, the numbers from tech are still going to be very good. So FactSet has the estimated growth rate for the IT sector, at least. And that doesn't include some of tech, which is part of communications. But if we just stick with the IT sector, FactSet has, or analysts have, third quarter earnings being up 29%. And that's up from the estimate earlier this summer. You know, analysts are always changing their estimates looking ahead. Earlier this summer for third quarter, analysts were looking at a 22% gain for third quarter earnings from the IT sector. Now we're at 28, almost 29.
It makes you wonder, Alex, how much better can things get?
Well, and of course it's all relative. So, you know, I think this is a slowdown of sorts, but it's still pretty good. And I think all investors need to see at this point is that things aren't falling off a cliff, right? I mean, I really do. I think everyone's been very worried. And so any reminder that things are still pretty good, I think kind of could reset the market a little bit. I'm not saying it's going to mean that 3 months from now or a month from now after earnings season is over, we're going to have a 10 or 15% rally. But maybe we just see the end of this kind of back and forth volatility and things holds in a little bit. And maybe the NASDAQ manages to retake, you know, a new all-time high. I mean, it would just need about a 5% gain for that. So I think that's possible.
That makes sense to me.
Yeah. And then just, you know, I love, I happen to love like little tidbits around earnings season. There's so many numbers, you can divide them up in different ways and look at them. One thing that I hadn't really seen before that I thought was interesting and I could share, not specific to tech really, but it's from a group called Wall Street Horizon. And they were tracking, given the uncertainty, how many S&P 500 companies have already confirmed their earnings dates. Right, because often these the companies have an estimated time and they do it around the same time each year within this earnings season, but they don't always confirm it until shortly before the actual earnings call. And so they pointed out that that companies are actually confirming these earnings dates just as they have in the same rates and at the same speed as which they that they have historically, and they see that as a positive sign. Because apparently, when companies delay earnings, or you know, it's that tends to be a sign or a harbinger of some bad news around the numbers. So that's really interesting to me. I don't think you can kind of bank on that, but it's a little clue, and it could be an interesting signal that companies are sticking with their earnings dates, and therefore feel relatively confident that they have, you know, and that things aren't so uncertain that they don't know how to report their earnings. So I think that was interesting.
Right. When you see that earnings are delayed, it usually is a harbinger of trouble.
Yeah.
But tell me, when does the parade of tech earnings actually begin?
Yeah. So Netflix has kind of become our unofficial kickoff, I would say, for a tech earnings season. And they report next week. It's really going to be interesting with Netflix. They're basically the first, I believe it's Tuesday. Although maybe I'll check that as we go. What's really interesting about Netflix is the stock is up 10% over the last month, right? It's easily outpacing the market. I think we talked a little bit about Netflix last week, but it's setting up for a very interesting earnings call.
Okay, don't tell me. I bet it's the Squid Game.
I think it is. It's funny that like something that's so consumer focused when it comes to a stock like Netflix really does matter and really does drive the stock. And yeah, so everyone is watching this new show, this new Korean show called The Squid Game, apparently. And actually Netflix, we've been all thinking about this. Netflix confirmed it yesterday. They tweeted that 111 million subscribers have now seen the show. Quote, making it our biggest series launch ever, they said.
Wow. So, have you seen it, Alex?
I have not.
Okay, so we won't have a Squid Game review on this call.
No. Have you?
No.
Okay. No. So, but I will review, but let's talk about a little bit. I think it is a fascinating case study for Netflix because, well, first of all, one thing we know about Netflix and the stock and its subscriber rate is that it really only takes one hit show in a given quarter to really make the numbers and surprise kind of on the upside when it comes to subscribers, which is what investors trade Netflix on. So that's one issue. What's so interesting with the Squid Game, I would say, is that, you know, the bullish argument for around Netflix for years was that Netflix had this massive opportunity internationally where it would spend all this money for new programming and that would really kind of hurt cash flow and earnings. But what they would be able to do over time is grow their international base, which was obviously, you know, almost limitless, and spread and people would watch those shows internationally. And that would basically kind of spread out the cost for Netflix to the point that their $15 billion or $18 billion in annual content spending wouldn't look so bad because they'd have a larger base of people. The bear case was that, well, that sounds great, but no one halfway across the world is going to be interested in some hit show from the US. I think what we've learned over the last couple of years is that in fact they have been interested, and that has really that helped Netflix over the last few years, I would say, until recently at least. What the Squid Game is showing, interestingly, is that same pattern works in reverse. Not only are people, you know, in Asia willing to watch US shows, but people in the US now are willing to watch shows that are from Asia that Netflix makes. And so you have like this, you have this great virtuous cycle for Netflix where everything works everywhere and they almost can't lose. And I think, it's been a really important dynamic for Netflix.
Don't count this company out. Yeah. It's particularly interesting though, because Netflix stock has done almost nothing for the past year prior to its latest rally. The stock is now at 633. What's the outlook from here?
Yeah, it is really interesting, right? This was almost like stuck for about, you had that first that big run during the first 6 months of the pandemic, and then it went nowhere.
Right.
And I think it plays into this debate. Well, before we get to where it goes, I mean, I think it's played into this debate about how tech companies are going to respond in the post-COVID world. Would these habits stick around, and was streaming due for a big crash? That was the question. And so I think, you know, like I said, I think this is a really big dynamic and a really big shift for Netflix that could take a while to play out. And I think investors will spend many months now kind of revaluing the company around kind of the Squid Game dynamic. So I do think this is a really good sign for Netflix. I think if it doesn't even show up in the subscriber numbers this quarter, it might show up in how Netflix talks about its forecast for the coming quarter, which could, you know, spur a big move for the stock. We'll see. We'll see if the 10% rally has already priced it in. My guess would be it hasn't, but that's more of a guess. But I think, and then bigger picture is, I think what's happening with Netflix is just a reminder that it is very difficult to just come up with a cut and dry argument around reopening stock, COVID, you know, pandemic stock. I mean, Netflix was certainly the ultimate pandemic stock. And now we're seeing that among tech, at least, and really among all companies, it's, as we get to this current stage of the reopening, it's rallying and outperforming. So I think we just need to be careful about being kind of making any black and white arguments around what kind of tech company, or even what kind of company something is now in terms of the pandemic versus the reopening.
I think that's fair. Everything is so different. We don't know how things will shake out. Do you think Netflix got a lift in part because Disney disclosed that subscriber growth was kind of slowing for its own streaming service?
Yeah, so that was what, like 2 weeks ago? And
just
I think
about.
That maybe helped start this rally to some degree, or give it some fuel, that Disney, which had been on fire with its streaming, was maybe struggling a little bit, which suggests, you know, A, either the competition for Netflix isn't quite as bad as everyone had feared. Yeah, so I think that's probably part of it. But I think this is also just a little bit of luck for Netflix probably, and evidence of their skills when it comes to programming.
I think they'd call it their skills.
They would, I'm sure.
For sure. So another topic we're going to hear a lot about during earnings season is the shortage of products and parts and even labor. We're seeing this all across the economy, and not only in the U.S., but globally. I'm curious about how shortages and supply chain bottlenecks are going to affect the tech sector. What's the view?
Yeah, so I think there are two questions, right? How will it affect the tech sector, and how will it affect tech stocks specifically?
Right.
It's certainly affecting the tech sector. It's affecting the entire economy. I mean, everyone is talking about it. And I think this is going to be the earnings season of shortage talk for sure. You know, just quickly, I ran some numbers the other day to give some context around this. And the last 3 months, you know, companies file their quarterly filings along the way after their earnings calls. And so within the quarterly filings with the SEC, about 160 companies in the S&P 500 mentioned shortages in their filings somewhere. It's roughly double from the same period 2 years ago, pre-COVID. And I think the takeaway for me here was that I looked at sort of who the leaders were in terms of mentions. And by the way, before I get to that, 71 of the companies that have so far reported third quarter earnings, and it's a small number, but there have been some, FactSet notes that 71% of them are citing the negative impact of supply chain.
That's a tremendous percentage.
Big number. You know, it's going to be this thing where I think for the most part, like maybe unless you're just a software company that has nothing in the way of components, right? I think everyone is going to bring up shortages. I mean, it would almost be silly not to, because A, you're going to be asked about it. And, you know, I don't know, maybe it's a little bit of a convenient excuse if things aren't quite as good as you want.
I was thinking that, Alex.
Yeah. Whether it's a yep. shortage or not. And I'm not downplaying the issue. I think it's a real issue. But anyway, I think we're going to see it across the board for that reason. But in terms of for an investor, you know, it's a really tricky question. Like, what do you do with that information when you get it, which we're going to be getting? And so just, you know, for some evidence of that. So from these numbers I ran, the company that had the most mentions of shortage in their SEC filing over the last 3 months was a company called Leggett & Platt. They make fabrics and materials for cars and homes, right? So not surprising that they'd be so outspoken about shortages. And their stock is basically flat over the last 12 months versus like a 24% gain for the market. So that kind of stands to reason. But then I ran the numbers for the number two most frequent mentioner of shortages, and that's the car dealer AutoNation. Also makes sense, right? Stocks, cars have really been in short supply and hard to get. But its stock has soared 92%. So it's like, what do you do with this information? And I'm not trying to punt on the question. And we can talk a little bit more about it, you know, about some specific companies. But I don't think there's a clear answer around how you trade around shortages in terms of, you know, and I think that's for the broad market as well as for the tech sector, because in some cases it depends what your position is when it comes to shortages. I think if you're in a strong position like Apple, shortages, yeah, I mean, they're not ideal, but like, people aren't going to substitute away from Apple products because there are shortages. I think they're rather, you know, they're going to wait.
Didn't Apple just say this week that it was dealing with a shortage and would cut back on supplies?
Yeah, so that's interesting, and I think this was fascinating. The caveat there is that Apple never talks about this stuff, we should say, and it was a Bloomberg report. They, you know, talked to suppliers and such. And so they reported that Apple was cutting its production for the iPhone 13 in the coming quarter because of component shortages. And this was a big deal. Everyone reacted. Wall Street reacted. Investors reacted. Apple fell like 1.5% after market. I think it was Tuesday night on the report. In the end, Apple stock was only down like 0.5% yesterday. So relatively minor impact on the stock. But everyone responded to it. Like there were tons of Wall Street notes about it, what it meant. So again, it's like, it speaks to the fact that everyone is really focused on shortages, even if we don't know what it's going to mean, even if we can't say what it'll mean for the near term or the long term for the stock.
So it's the problem of the moment, but it's also the buzzword of the moment.
I think so. Yeah.
So speaking of Apple, we have a reader question from Lori. She wanted to know about your latest thoughts on the stock. Tell us what you're thinking about Apple these days. And yeah, whether the shortages matter short term only or longer term, what's your view on Apple?
Yeah, I would say that these shortages should really have, I guess if you're like a day trader and you want to trade around it, you know, you could try. I don't see any reason to take shortages into account at all when it comes to whether you buy, sell, or hold Apple stock, right? I mean, first of all, they're probably number one on every list of every manufacturer's list in terms of who gets priority, right?
Certainly you'd want to satisfy Apple.
It's got to be Apple. So I think they're in a really good position when it comes to shortages. I mean, I'd make the argument that shortages could be a positive for Apple, right? I mean, let's think about how people use their iPhones now. And yes, new iPhone sales are still very important for Apple, but are you going to switch away from your iPhone because you can't get a new one yet? Unless you know your phone is totally broken, you're going to hold it for a while, and you'll get your new phone when you can, because you're locked into the ecosystem, which includes MacBooks, AirPods, iPads, MacBooks, right? I mean, it's like
everything you might be.
So like, I don't see this being a real factor for Apple. We talked about Apple recently. I'm fairly bullish on the long term of Apple. I think the 5G opportunity is still really big. And if you believe in 5G, I think Apple, at least as a consumer play, is probably still the best way to play it. So that's just one other area I would pay attention to.
So mindful of time, Alex, I want to ask you one more question about shortages.
Sure.
When you look at the supply shortages in chips and in everything else, what does it mean for consumer prices in technology? Does it mean that people are going to have to pay a lot more for gadgets this holiday season? Are gifts going to be a lot more expensive? What do you think the impact is?
No, it's a great question. I think we're going to hear more about this in the coming weeks as, you know, people put out their holiday forecasts and such. And I don't necessarily have any hard evidence of anything here yet. My sense is that when it comes to like the big products that are out there, we can go back to the iPhone, we can talk about video game consoles, all of these things which are dealing with shortages. they kind of have like these defined price points, and they've been there. They've been that way for years, right? So the base level iPhone 13 is $799. The iPhone 13 is $999. The Nintendo Switch, I'm pretty sure, is $299. Other video game consoles are $399. Like these are set prices. So I don't see those big holiday things changing much. Now, obviously, anything in the third, in the aftermarket where you're competing to buy something on eBay, whole different story, right? And as we've seen, video game consoles, they sell for $1,000 because you can't, or more, because you can't find them. So that's a whole different volume. In terms of what the companies themselves will do, I would be surprised if we see a big wave of price increases. Now, where I think we will maybe notice a difference, and this will be interesting to watch, is like those bargains that you find on Amazon, from smaller companies or these third party sellers that are using Amazon for the fulfillment. I imagine they're going to be squeezed a little bit, and you may see fewer bargains for some of these kind of less known products. But you know, that's just my sort of educated guess, I would have to say.
Well, this is a story we'll be watching in the next month or so.
Yeah.
Give me a quick summary. When should we hear from the rest of big tech?
Netflix reports next week, as we said. And I just want to check one thing to make sure nothing changed.
While you're checking, I want to remind listeners to send us questions about tech, and we'll cover them at the end of the call.
Yeah. Okay, good. So I was just checking one thing because I wanted to. Netflix reports next week, and then the rest of kind of the FANG trade is due up the following week. So it's Microsoft, Facebook, Apple, and Google are all due to report the week of October 25th. That's generally also like right around the peak of earnings season, is sort of end of October, early November. The one big tech company that hasn't yet confirmed their date is Amazon. They always report with the rest of those big tech companies, so I'm pretty sure Amazon will be the week of October 25th as well. But as far as I know, I have not yet seen them confirm that yet.
Well, we've got another call scheduled that week, so you'll be catching us up on all those.
Oh my God, we'll have lots to talk about.
Yes.
And actually, so before we move on, Lauren, I wanted to, and this Amazon reminds me, and we've talked about this a little bit, but I kind of can't let the call go without talking about the rather prominent placement that Barron's cover got this week in Jeff Bezos's Twitter feed. I'm guessing some of our listeners saw this, but the Amazon CEO tweeted a cover of our 1999 Barron's cover, which was titled Amazon.bomb. This has been famous around our office for a long time and in sort of the tech world. Basically, it had a photo of a bomb with Bezos's face on it. He cited, and just to catch readers up before I turn to you, Lauren, he cited this, the cover before. It's basically like been motivation for him for 20 years. So anyway, I've been at Barron's a long time, but I was not there in 1999. I know you were. So I thought it would be fun to talk a little bit about that cover, what you remember about it, and sort of even that time covering tech and how Barron's covered it back then.
Oh, good question, Alex. I suppose we should feel insulted that he's poking fun at Barron's, but you know what they say, anything about us, good or bad, just keep talking about us.
Yeah, right, exactly.
But the real thing is, I think Amazon investors should thank us for motivating Bezos to build one of the world's great companies.
There you go.
It's worth a mere $1.7 trillion. So on behalf of Barron's, you're welcome, everyone. But let me explain that the cover reflected our view at the time that the prices of dot-com companies were completely out of whack with fundamentals. And Amazon at the time was merely a bookseller. And he'd taken bookselling, a kind of low margin, not terribly profitable business, found a new way to sell books. And we just could not understand why the stock had exploded, why so many dot-com stocks had exploded. Most of them had, or almost all these companies had minimal sales. They had no earnings. They had no prospects for earnings. Yep. And they were burning through a lot of money. Barron's wrote a story called Burn Rate that kind of marked the top of the dot-com boom in 2000.
March of 2000, I think, right?
Ends of March. Right. It was a statistical study that looked at the amount of money these dot-com companies were burning through, and speculated on how many would not make it to see the next year, maybe even the next month. We were certainly wrong about Amazon in the long term. I think we were right in the short term. The stock did go down about 71% in the, I think it was in the 2 years that followed our story.
That's,
so
that's right.
Take that, Jeff Bezos. We were not entirely wrong.
Yeah.
And investing is all about timing as well as all about making the right decision.
Yeah, it's so fascinating. And look, like, we can't get too personal about these things, right? And certainly he has every right to tweet that. And maybe we do deserve it. But it's like, you know, there's no entrepreneur out there probably that is going to tweet our burn rate cover and the fact that we call the top of the market. So whatever, for whatever it's worth, it is interesting to...
But we're not too sensitive about it because every week we get to put out more opinions about things. We'll be proven right or wrong. But I think the takeaway from this is that while we were right in the short term, like many, many people and many publications, we didn't fully grasp the power of the internet and the monumental disruptions that would follow. And it makes me wonder what we're missing in today's market.
Yeah.
And, you know, I look around the market. Sometimes I look at biotech, which I write a lot about and cover. And many people have likened what is happening in biotech to what happened in the technology sector in the late 90s and early 2000s. There's a lot of tremendously high priced stocks of companies that have no products and no profits, but could be on the cusp of revolutionary developments. So,
yeah.
I think we always have to ask ourselves, what are we missing?
Totally. Yeah, no, it's a great point.
So that's my
to learn. Yeah.
Anyway, before we close, I'm going to turn the tables on you and ask you to tell us a little bit more about your new podcast and the future of autonomous driving.
Yeah, thank you. I would love to talk about it because it's been really fun.
All right, we'll give you 2 minutes and then we've got some listener questions.
Great. Okay. So basically we've been, and it's a similar idea to what you were just talking about, because for the last few months, I've been working on this project around self-driving. It comes from this column I wrote earlier in the year when I was thinking back to an interview I had done almost 10 years earlier, when a financial advisor and sort of futurist told me that my daughter, who is 2, would never learn to drive a car. And it was fascinating. It really stuck with me, right? Well, now she's about to turn 12, and I'm pretty sure she's going to be taking that driver's test. So
good luck to you.
That is definitely on my mind and how that will go. So, but ultimately, the column is kind of this idea that we have to keep in mind that innovation really isn't inevitable. And that has, you know, a lot of meaning in how we talk about the future. And for investors, I think how we value technology companies, the very thing we were just talking about with Amazon, even, right?
Correct.
Doesn't mean we're always going to be right, right? So anyway, we spent, I think this sort of a self-driving, which has become really symbolic for me about how I think about innovation, how I cover it, and how we value it. And so, you know, the podcast is about how we missed our deadlines around self-driving cars. They were supposed to be here by 2020, it was what everyone was saying. That was the year. Well, we don't have that. We have some self-driving taxis in different places around the country and world, but no self-driving cars in our driveways. So it's just so fascinating. And it's really not just about technology. It's about ethics, regulations, insurance, even philosophical questions. It touches on everything. So we talk to people in all those areas for the podcast, entrepreneurs. We talk to the former director of DARPA, which was really fun, public company CEOs, and even activists who hate the idea of adding more cars to our roads, even if they're going to be safer self-driving cars. So there's so many different angles here, and it's really been fun. That's it. First episode was out yesterday, and then we're going to be releasing new episodes every week for the next few months.
And you can listen on Apple and Spotify and every place.
All the regular podcast places. Yep.
Excellent. That's a really neat topic, Alex.
Yeah, thanks. It should be.
And I like that it covers so many areas. So we have a question here from, I do not know, we don't have a first name, but the writer writes that he asked on a previous call whether Alex thought tech stocks would outperform conventional stocks over the next 10 years. Uh-huh. And taking that question a bit further, he wonders, what sectors of tech would you say one has to have participation in order to ride the tech wave higher? For example, should you be betting on semiconductors, big tech, cybersecurity, electric vehicles, a batch of sectors, one sector? What do you think?
Wow. Okay. Let's see.
And we could do a whole podcast on this.
Can I say, you know, I'll answer all of the above. But no, I think, you know, part of the your portfolio should really be in all of them. Don't choose, right? But then, you know, in other pockets, you know, you might want to, where you want to like be more overweight something, I suppose. I think one area that is probably smart is, you know, the enterprise, because it doesn't get a lot of attention all the time, right? How businesses are using companies, enterprise software companies, you know, Salesforce, companies like that, to change things, to push forward this digital transformation that I still think is in the early innings. I think the cloud companies, and that applies sort of, big tech's a player there, Oracle's a player there, IBM's a player there, Google's a player there. I think the cloud, the upside just remains so huge. We've talked about this before, that there's that it's hard to see a peak for those stocks yet.
It's hard to see a sort of post-cloud world and to know what would come next.
Yeah, I think we're still really in the early ages of that. Let's see.
Where would you put chip stocks?
Yeah, I mean, chip stocks are interesting. I mean, because ultimately they're sort of, it's like so much more of a manufacturing business. I think chips have gotten a lot sexier in the last 18 months, which is great because they are so vital to the world. So yeah, I don't think you can really go wrong with chip stocks. We didn't talk about Taiwan Semi. They just reported their numbers today.
Oh, tell me what they said. I didn't
know. So their numbers are good. They gave a good outlook. I think their earnings outlook for the rest of the year was higher than what anyone expected. But they did say that the shortages would last through, they thought the shortages for chips would last through 2022. So, you know, that's going to overlay kind of the story there. But they are the key maker of advanced chips for everyone that doesn't, you know, Intel makes their own chips, but pretty much everyone else relies on Taiwan Semi to make chips for them. So that's Apple, AMD, NVIDIA, all these really important companies that have chips in-house now. So I think Taiwan Semiconductor, there is an ADR in the US, I think is a really important company for the future of the world, if I, you know, not to put it, not to be.
Well, it's so important that China and the US are fighting over it.
That's right. And that maybe that's one risk, by the way, because we've heard about, you know, the sort of scary talk around China and Taiwan. That's probably the one thing, the one true risk factor for Taiwan Semiconductor. And let's hope it doesn't come to that. But I think that is a stock that you can sort of buy now and hold on to for a very long time, knowing that there's no way this world works without Taiwan, there's no way the digital transformation works without Taiwan Semi, you know, at the core.
Right. I think that's a good point. And for those taking notes, the ticker for Taiwan Semi in the US is TSM. And Alex, I think we're going to leave it there. Just tell me yes or no. Do you think tech earnings are going to come in around what analysts expect, say 29% higher or so?
I say, because they're always a little bit better than we expect. So, you know, the conservative growth figure we'll say is 35% for the quarter.
All right. We'll check back in 2 weeks and see how things are going.
All right. Thanks, Laura.
All right. Much appreciated. Thank you to our listeners as well for tuning in today. Please join us again tomorrow on Barron's Live to learn what's next for the Fed and how markets might react to new spending and tax initiatives. Barry Knapp, managing partner at Ironsides Macroeconomics, will join Barron's writer Lisa Bielfus to discuss monetary policy, fiscal policy, and coming changes at the Federal Reserve. Thanks again, everybody, for joining us today. Stay well and have a good day.